stay away from thinking, oh, it's just dementia.
You are listening to The Alzheimer's Podcast with Mike Good of Togetherness, your number one resource for practical tips and insights, empowering you and your family to live well with Alzheimer's. Hello and welcome to episode 39 of The Alzheimer's Podcast. I'm Mike Good of Togetherness. Thank you for joining me for another podcast, for my goal is always to empower you to maintain a positive experience, reduce and eliminate the need for medications, and make your time together with those you care for the best it can be. Today we have another episode of Navigating Rough Terrain with Christy Turner, the Dementia Sherpa. Christy and I will continue our conversation on how to know when it's time to intervene or get professional help. This is the fourth episode in this six-part series. Be sure to check out episodes 36, 37, and 38 if you missed them. In this episode, we're going to discuss how to know when changes in behavior require intervention. I am so pleased to have Christy Turner, the Dementia Sherpa, as a regular guest here on The Alzheimer's Podcast. She provides a level of knowledge, empathy, and compassion that's unrivaled and that I believe you will find very helpful and refreshing. She is a certified dementia practitioner, certified dementia care unit manager, and cognitive stimulation instructor. She has run award-winning memory care communities in assisted living and skilled nursing levels of care. Using her 16 years of experience and working with over 1,100 people living with dementia and their families, she's developed a system that helps families move from crisis management to confidence. Hello, Christy. It's great to have you back on The Alzheimer's Podcast to continue our discussion on how to know when it's time to intervene or get professional help.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks for having me back. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Thank you for being here, and I look forward to it as well. So, Christy, changes in usual behavior is the third area that we're discussing, and I noticed that you actually wrote two separate articles on these signs, so there must be a lot to cover in this area, huh?
I feel like there is. Of course, this is, you know, a topic that I'm so passionate about, so I can always find something to say about it. But I think sometimes too, people can become overwhelmed if they're seeing everything all at one time. So I kind of broke it up into two pieces.
I see. And one thing you said in one of the articles, I think, is you said sometimes it's really obvious something's off and requires intervention. Other times we notice things are unusual, but we aren't sure if we should be alarmed and do something or chill out and let it go. I think that's a wonderful way to kind of wrap up how our care partners and our listeners feel about this, and helping them know when it's time to intervene is so important.
Yeah, it is. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of the advice out there is like, well, go with your gut. And I do say that to people in certain circumstances because I think it's important. But going with your gut is another way of saying, you know, go with your instinct. And what does that come from? Well, it comes from your judgment. What does judgment come from? It comes from experience. Right. Does experience come from bad judgment? So my point being, if this is your first experience, how are you going to know the difference?
Exactly. So I think it's wonderful that you've put this list together. And I know, you know, behaviors is such a, it's a very wide topic. There's just so many things under it. But you said that that's someone's changes in behavior is one of the main reasons people contact you.
Mm-hmm.
And at the top of the list is aggressive and violent behavior. You also say, well, I got a few quotes from you now. It's not true that people living with dementia all just get to this point. Is that really, people really feel that way, huh?
People do because that's what they've been told.
Okay.
We're in this situation for reasons surpassing my understanding that people are more apt to believe what their coworkers, neighbors, cousin said than somebody who's an expert, and I don't understand why, but I think, you know, part of it may be just, I don't know, water cooler conversation or whatever, but there's a lot of misinformation out there about dementia, and this is one of the big ones, is that, well, you know, that's just what happens, and at a certain point, they all get, you know, they all have these behaviors, and they get really aggressive, and sometimes violent, and you got to put them on medication, and then you got to put them in a home. Well, that's a bunch of hooey. Not true. None of that is true. Not everybody gets like this. Most people don't get like this. And if somebody is really aggressive or violent, typically the environment, and sometimes that means the care partner, is in some way contributing to it. That doesn't mean on purpose. It's mostly, in my experience, it's almost always unwittingly. But, you know, so start right there. Why is this happening? And then if we understand why it's happening, you know, 99 times out of 100, that eliminates the need for medication. And if this, you know, if someone is not behaving in a violent manner, not being aggressive with their care partner, usually then that's not really a problem at home, right? And people aren't thinking about needing to make a decision about memory care. So it just eliminates a lot of problems if we can figure out why something's happening.
What I've witnessed from reading case studies and seeing examples is a lot of time, as you said, unwittingly, the care partner tries to use logic or get their loved one to act like they used to act, and that builds this frustration between the two individuals, and that always, and even in, you know, my relationship, that always leads to a little argumentative behavior, we'll say. So it's always, so it's important, and I love how you teach us how to rephrase how we say things to help avoid those situations.
Right. And so one thing is just starting with behaviors. Is it behaviors or is it communication that you don't enjoy? And that's typically what people are talking about. And so when we just like dial it back a little bit and understand that, you know, we're talking about somebody whose whole brain is under attack, then things start to make sense in a completely different way. So if somebody's whole brain is under attack, that means that the part of their brain that controls executive function, which is where reason and logic are housed, if we understand that part of their brain is under attack, then suddenly we can see that doesn't make a lot of sense to try to use reason and logic, right?
True.
And if we understand that the whole brain is under attack and so that affects language, then it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to think that they could just tell us what they want instead of showing us. That's why people do the things they do. That's why all of us do the things we do, because it makes sense to us in that moment, right? Seemed like a good idea at the time. And because we're trained to convey a message to the people around us. So when we reframe it and look at it that way, then we can start thinking about it differently. We can start talking about it differently.
That's true. And one of the things that I've seen repeated by care partners that causes, that lead, can lead to this, is sometimes a loved one is wanting to do something, but the environment's restricting them, or the care partner's restricting them from having that independence, such as they're confused and they want to leave the house, for instance, and they're trying to go outside, but you're trying to keep them inside and protect them, and that just exasperates the situation.
Yeah, so I think, you know, in this article, I mentioned again addition before subtraction, right? And we've talked about this on the podcast, and I think this is addition before subtraction is one of our most popular episodes.
It is.
That really resonated with people. So I do encourage people to go back and listen to that to really see what we're talking about. But in the example that you gave about, you know, we're trying to keep our person indoors, right? So my perspective on that is, first of all, why are we trying to do that? Is something bad going to happen if they walk outside? And by bad, I mean, you know, life-altering. So if we want to keep somebody inside because it's raining outside, and if they walk outside, they're going to get wet, that's just called a natural consequence, and that's okay, right? We have towels. We can be right there with a warm, fluffy towel when they turn around and come right back in and go, oh, you know, they don't like that. That's fine. It's always better if someone experientially can come to their own conclusion than if we need to tell someone. Not always possible. For example, we're never going to let anybody walk into oncoming traffic. That would just, we don't want them to experience that. But for going outside, you know, if it's weather related, okay. Now, if they open the door to go outside and the porch steps are gone because that's under construction, that's a different story. That would be dangerous. So, of course, we would want to get away from that exit. A good way to do that would be to offer something away from the door. You know, you want to go outside? Okay, this door isn't safe. Come this way. We want to offer something that's going to get someone to come along with us, right? Go for another exit. Go outside. And maybe somebody just needed to be outside to take a deep breath and get some fresh air, and they're fine after 2 minutes. They're ready to come back in. That's okay.
That's good advice. And I think you also mentioned that pain can be responsible for causing some of the aggressive behavior.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's something that we're not great as, when I say we, I mean professionals, we're not great about conveying that to families, nor great about recognizing it. So this is one of my little soapbox issues that I talk about quite a bit. One of the most common things that we see in long-term care is Mary needs help with getting dressed. And so Janie, the CNA, goes in to help Mary with getting dressed, and she's trying to help Mary get her shirt on over her head, and Mary starts yelling and jerking back, and Janie's like, we're almost there, and then Mary punches Janie in the face. And then Mary ends up on medication because she's aggressive and violent. What's actually going on is Mary has bursitis and maybe a strained rotator cuff, and she still is wearing shirts that need to be pulled over her head instead of button-down shirts or zip-up shirts. And Janie didn't have any experience with Mary, or was just an inexperienced caregiver, and didn't know that the sign was, you know, when she was wincing, it wasn't like, that was not a sign to power through. That was a sign to stop and let's figure out something different. And people, again, when people are having so-called behaviors or communicating with us in a way we don't enjoy, it's because they're trying to tell us something in the only way that makes sense to them in that moment. And so that's a really good example of how people act in a way to try and show us they're in pain.
Yeah, I like the shoulder bursitis example because I can relate to it with
mine. Me too, that's why I used it.
and it doesn't always show itself just when I'm raising my arms over my head. It shows itself when I'm trying to raise myself out of a chair, or I'm trying to lift something with that one arm. So that pain can show up in different activities, is what I wanted to say.
Right. Yeah. So it's not a constant thing. Same for me. I don't really think about it because I don't do too much in the way of repetitive tasks anymore. But every time I'm in the airport and need to go through the scanner, I have to say to security, my shoulder only goes up this high. You know, my elbow does not get parallel with my shoulder. It's only going to go up this high. Right. That's how it works now.
And I was just visualizing if someone was actually trying to raise my arm against my will and I knew it hurts. I'm the fight kind of guy. So I'm not the flight kind of guy. So I would be instantly fighting back and pushing them myself. So I could definitely see how that can easily occur and be but I would be forgiven. I'd be, oh yeah, he just, you know, he's okay. But we tend to not treat our loved ones with dementia that same way.
I think it can be a combination of things where, you know, the care partner, the family care partner may not always be putting that together, like, oh, that's what's going on. although family care partners do tend to be better about that type of thing, because of course they remember that they're intimately aware of somebody's history, right? And including injuries. But sometimes it's not always top of mind. And also, you know, people, again, I'll say again, people don't know what they don't know. So if you're not putting together that XYZ injury is going to cause pain, and that pain is going to be expressed in this way by somebody who has dementia and is that this particular part of the disease process, then you're going to be surprised when you have an outcome that you don't like.
So, Christy, on your list of signs to look for behavioral changes, you list dramatic changes in behavior or personality. Can you give us some examples of what would fall under that category?
Yeah, most often this relates to people who ultimately get a diagnosis of frontotemporal dementia, because that's typically where you see the dramatic changes. And because it's a younger onset, so we could be talking about somebody who's maybe in their late 40s, 50s, and comes home one day and says, "Look, I got a new car. And it's a bright red sports car, and the minivan is gone." You're like, "You what? Huh? What happened here?" That's a pretty dramatic change, especially if the person was always very responsible, and now they just went out and made a big ticket purchase without consulting their spouse. That's pretty dramatic. Typically, when FTD is involved, there are some other things. There are kind of a bunch of things that are happening concurrently. So that's one sign. Another can be sexual promiscuity. And so I don't say that in a judgmental way. I'm saying that in a way of people have been married for, let's say, you know, 30 years. 40 years maybe, and all of a sudden their spouse is not coming home from work, and it's 10 p.m., and now a friend is calling you saying, "Oh my God, I just saw your husband at the Applebee's with some floozy," you know, that kind of thing, where it's like, this is completely wild, uncharacteristic. You would have bet this never would have happened. And so what happens is when people are showing dramatic personality changes like this, a lot of times the label we give them is midlife crisis. Oh, Joe's going through a midlife crisis. He traded in the minivan for the sports car. He was caught down at the Applebee's with some floozy nobody's ever seen. She must be half his age. And now, you know, he's taken her to Las Vegas and they're gambling. And so compulsive type behaviors, impulse purchases, spending big chunks of money, gambling, drinking, sexual promiscuity, could be illicit drug use also. All of those things lumped together, we've got a big, big problem, Houston. So that's usually when the spouse is going, "That's it. I'm out. I am filing for divorce." And the person who's showing all of these personality changes, this is actually when they need the most help. They need to get into a neurology appointment like yesterday to figure out what's going on. People can lose their jobs, their marriages, their homes, their IRAs. Like, it's bad.
That's got to be a really tough situation, because you, as an untrained, I mean, we're not trained as healthcare professionals for the most part. And when our loved one changes their behaviors like that, for us to actually sit back and go, "Hey, this could be health related and not just because they're going through a midlife crisis," that would be an extremely difficult point of observation.
Definitely. And I'm just hoping that somebody who hears this happens to mention it to a friend
right.
who happens to, like, "Hey, what?" Because it is, you know, it's not the most common thing in the world. In my universe, it's more common. But just a good rule of thumb is any sudden changes in mm-hmm. anything, something is wrong. There shouldn't be a sudden dramatic change in somebody's personality or mood. That's a sign that something has run amok, gone amiss, and you need to seek some medical intervention. That it's the same, often that's a cue that there's a urinary tract infection. And, you know, somebody is usually just pretty happy-go-lucky and pleasant to be around, and all of a sudden they have no idea where they are, who they are, who you are, and they're kind of cranky. That's not just dementia. Please, you know, stay away from thinking, oh, it's just dementia. No, again, sudden dramatic changes are a problem. They really do require medical evaluation.
One thing I really like that you're doing is that you're showing and teaching us and our listeners, me and the listeners, how different types of dementia can present with different signs. It's a good reason that getting the proper diagnosis, it can be helpful because it helps you know what to look out for and what's going on. And Lewy body dementia is another one that comes up. And I want to swing into this one because delusions and hallucinations are more common with that type of dementia, I believe. Is that true?
With Lewy bodies, yes, absolutely. Unfortunately, that's where you're most likely to see them. And Lewy bodies is just a really tough process, not only for the person who has the diagnosis, but for their care partners. And it's my observation that care partners of people with dementia with Lewy bodies and care partners of people with frontotemporal dementia certainly have the most challenges in their home and in their life. It's very tough. Now, for you know, one of the really important reasons that we would want to know that somebody has dementia with Lewy bodies is just like we would want to know about any other diagnosis. So we know what to expect so that we can plan appropriately and we can intervene appropriately. And so for people with dementia with Lewy bodies or people with Parkinson's disease with dementia for that matter, mm-hmm. because that also has Lewy bodies, the reason we want to know that is because they can have a secondary condition that affects how their body is able or rather unable to metabolize medications. So just one dose of the wrong medication can be lethal for somebody with that diagnosis. And unfortunately, as a whole in the medical community, how we still treat people living with dementia who have so-called aggressive behaviors or so-called inappropriate behaviors or so-called, you know, hallucinations, delusions, whatever, anything that we kind of don't really like or that's kind of tough on a care partner, the answer typically is to give the person living with dementia antipsychotic medication. Which antipsychotic medication is a godsend for people living with schizophrenia or bipolar affective disorder or some other type of psychiatric diagnosis. The problem is that dementia with Lewy bodies, Parkinson's disease with dementia, Alzheimer's disease, frontotemporal dementia, all of those dementias, none of them are a psychiatric illness. So be kind of like, you know, giving somebody an antifungal cream to treat their heart condition. What does one have to do with the other? Nothing really. Right. And so it's almost like putting a Band-Aid on something, except this Band-Aid could be more harmful than doing any type of good. And so that's why it's important to really try to dial down on what's actually happening, why it's happening, and again, seek medical attention promptly, because it could be a matter of life and death.
Yeah, that's why I think having this conversation on behaviors and how to treat them without the use of medications is so important. And if people, listeners, want to learn more about the use of antipsychotics, the inappropriate use, then episode 3, I covered this topic because to me it's so important. I also wanted to mention, though, with the hallucinations, something that really surprised me is that hallucinations are not only visual, but they can be auditory and olfactory.
Yep.
And I have an online friend who says that she always smells like burning wires in her house, yet there's nothing burning. So she always thinks there's an electrical fire, and she has to go through that anxiety and realization constantly.
Yeah, I have somebody in my life who has experienced, how do I say this? When she experiences olfactory hallucinations, we know that something is wrong with her medication and she needs prompt medical attention because things are about to go off the rails. So that's like one of the first signs. And her diagnosis is bipolar affective disorder. So again, totally different, right? But they're not, olfactory hallucinations aren't super common, but they do happen and it's important people know that they happen. I think for people with dementia with Lewy bodies, what I see most often are visual hallucinations.
Okay.
In people with Alzheimer's disease, I have seen both auditory and visual hallucinations. And so in both Alzheimer's disease and dementia with Lewy bodies, we know that, and also Parkinson's disease with dementia, we know that the visual field is going to be affected and people start having a lot of problems with the visuospatial relationship and misjudging what's going on in their environment. And so, for example, a black mat in front of a door can be actually used as a restraint because people misperceive that as a bottomless pit. Low lighting can make a bookcase look like a threatening person in the environment. So sometimes we can make environmental changes that will alleviate those symptoms. And then for people with dementia with Lewy bodies or Parkinson's disease with dementia, a lot of times they'll be aware that they're having a hallucination and can tell you more about it. So you can say, what do you see or what do you hear? What do you smell? What's going on? Tell me more about it. And they'll tell you and come to the conclusion that this seems real, but I know it's not real.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Whereas for somebody with Alzheimer's disease, you're not going to get that response at all. It's going to be 100% real. And so, again, that's another reason to know what the actual diagnosis is. That's pretty important, too.
In my online course where I talk about adapting the home for dementia, I cover a lot of these, what I call triggers that we can make changes in the home environment, like increase the lighting in that example to eliminate shadows and to help reduce and avoid these hallucinations or just the thought that we saw something that really wasn't there. Christy, as we wrap up today, the last thing I'm wondering if you can briefly touch on is loss of motivation and apathy as one of the signs of behavior changes.
Yeah, so a couple of things can be going on there. One can be somebody's at a point in the disease process where they're not able to hold on to a thought long enough to carry it through to a meaningful conclusion. And there's no question when somebody is at that point in the disease process, there's no question about intervention. It needs to happen. Because if somebody cannot hold on to a thought long enough to carry it through to a meaningful action, that means they're going to get hungry. And if they don't happen to be in the kitchen in front of a food source, they're going to go hungry. Toileting. Sleep, a comfortable place to sleep, clean clothes, everything you can think of. So somebody absolutely positively needs intervention when they get to that point. And it's not that they're being apathetic or that they don't give a rip about what's going on around them or that they're just sitting there like a bump on a log. That's why it's happening. So that's one thing.
I can just see that also being mistaken for depression, which you also have as a common or not common, but on your list.
Depression is very highly correlated with dementia. It's treatable, and so there's screening for that specific to people living with dementia. So, as an observational tool, so it is important to know what's going on. But going back to the kind of apathy piece, that can be a sign of frontotemporal dementia, and so it's important to know that too. And again, when we were talking earlier about, you know, maybe a guy comes home with a brand new red sports car and he's hanging out at the local bar with somebody he shouldn't be, somebody he's not married to, and blowing a lot of money, and yet he seems really apathetic about anything around the house, right?
Right.
I don't care that the fence is falling down. I'm not interested in interacting with you, and not in a cold shoulder way, but just in a, I don't have any interest in any of this kind of a way. And so that's another sign to look for. So, and it doesn't have to be all of the signs altogether. It can be any of them, but apathy is very, very common in frontotemporal dementia.
So as we wrap up today, do you have one last final thought for our listeners?
I just really feel like it is always so much better to intervene and ask for forgiveness later if you need to, rather than crossing your fingers and hoping for the best and kind of sticking your head in the sand. The thing is, professionals around you can help you. And the longer you wait for help, typically the more professionals are going to need to be involved, and the longer it's going to take to kind of untangle a situation, and the more expensive. So early intervention actually is more cost effective. It certainly is a lot better on your stress level, and you're going to sleep better at night. You're going to know your person is safe and you're on the right track with your plan if you go ahead and move forward with that. So I would just encourage intervention.
I want to thank you very much, Christy, for creating this series of resources for our listeners and to know when to intervene or to help them intervene. I think that's just an incredible resource.
My pleasure.
And I believe next episode we'll be talking about physical changes. I had to think. So, all right. Well, Christy, thanks again. And bye now.
Bye.
You've been listening to The Alzheimer's Podcast with Mike Good of Togetherness. For more information and to get the resources mentioned in this episode, visit togetherness.com/podcast.